We're doing Parsha Shmos summary. We're beginning the book of Shmos, and it's important to remember that these Parshos from Shmos through Yisro are to a great extent the basis of our religion. If there's one thing, if there's one event in history that everyone agrees to, all religions agree to, no one contests, it's Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jewish people leaving Egypt. Every religion that came after that had to say, yeah, God chose the Jewish people, took them out of Egypt, but they all began with this, with our parshios. So when I was discussing philosophy with friends in high school, so at one point we asked ourselves, why don't our parents sit us down once and say, you know, this is what happened, this is our tradition, this is what being Jewish is all about. If we have this tradition that this is what went on, why don't we have a more direct passing on? And then we thought about it and we say, actually we do. On the night of Pesach, that's what's happening the night of Pesach. Well, what are our parents telling us? They're saying, you should know, I'm sitting with you, like my parents sat with me, like their parents sat with them, going back to Yetzias Mitzrayim, going back till the story we're reading about, till the time of the Torah, this has been happening. Father or grandfather has been telling over to his son or grandson, this is where it all began, with the Jewish people being slaves in Egypt. Our parsha begins with a description of how the Jewish people were put down slowly but surely, befarech, they were made to work. Our sages say befarech is the words beferach, with a soft mouth. They began speaking sweetly, they began saying everyone's going to join in the work. Even Paro was made to join the workforce. And then slowly but surely they pulled out, and the Jews, being exceptionally loyal citizens, continued, and slowly but surely they were made into slaves. It's interesting that the Jewish people begin with Avram's father. Avram's father serves idols. He has a shop where he sells idols. And then Avram discovers God, and Avram's son Yitzchak, Yaakov. And then again we go down. We go down to Egypt and we become slaves. And we come out of Mitzrayim, that's when we receive the Torah. And we have a tradition that it's very important to remember our roots. And our roots isn't... We could say the roots begin at Sinai. And our tradition is no. That it's very important when we sit at the Leila Seder, Matchil Begnut Umzeh Mishvach. You have to start with the disgrace of the Jewish people. We start the Seder night by remembering we weren't always the way we are today. We weren't always Jewish. We weren't always like this. And two opinions where we have to begin the story. Well, one opinion says we begin with Arami Oved Avi. We begin the story with the fact that our great-great-great-grandfather, Avram's father, he used to serve idols. Arami Oved Avi was... the story of how Yaakov was by Lavan, and how Lavan tried to wipe out Yaakov. And we start in Mitchilav Davdazra Yuavatenu, our forefathers used to serve idols. Terach, Avram's father, he served idols. That's one understanding. And another understanding says, Matchil Begnut is our parsha. You begin with the disgrace of the Jewish people, that the Jewish people started off as slaves. That's our parsha. We were enslaved in Egypt. What does the word Mitzrayim mean?
Narrow place.
Okay, I could say narrow place. Mitzrayim happens to be a name. One of Ham's children was called Mitzrayim. Ham was the son of Noach. Noach had a son named Ham, and he had a son named Mitzrayim. We say it every night in Ma'ariv. In the evening prayer, we say that God took us out of the land of... He took the Jewish people out of Admas Bnei Ham. In the prayer that... In the blessing that follows... Krishna, we say God took us out of the land of the sons of Ham. Who are the sons of Ham? That's Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim was a man who was the son of Ham, who was the son of Noah, and he founded the country of Mitzrayim. And the word Mitzrayim, it's true what you said, it comes from the root of tsar, narrow or enemy. What does an enemy do? He tries to oppress. So that's the idea of Mitzrayim. And when we read about the time we were in Mitzrayim, we have to remember that this is a sign for all the oppressors that would come upon the Jewish people. This is the beginning. This is what's called Kura Barzel. The Navi calls Mitzrayim, the Torah calls Mitzrayim. Kur HaBarzel. Kur is, how do you say it in English? Kur is the place where you purify metal. It's hotter than a furnace. It's a
crucible,
right. Mitzrayim is the crucible. Mitzrayim is the place where the metal is purified. That's where the Jewish people were purified. Now, the Parsha doesn't tell us a lot about specific people. The Parsha tells us the Jewish people were enslaved. And then Pharaoh called in the midwives. We don't even know who the midwives are. We're given these names, Shifra and Pua, and our sages say Shifra and Pua are nicknames. They're not really Shifra and Pua. They're either Yocheved and Elisheva, Yocheved and their daughter Miriam. And he tells them, look, when the children are born, see if it's a son, then kill him. And that's how he tries to do away with the Jewish people. Our sages say it was a pretty silly plan, because all you need is one male to impregnate thousands of women. The Jewish people could have went on. He should have rather killed the women. You need women for children. The woman is limited. She has 9 months. She could bring a child. The men, they're unlimited. So why did he want to kill the males? So our tradition says that his stargazers looked in the stars and they saw that the rescuer of the Jewish people was soon to be born. So he told the midwives, look, there's going to be a boy and he's going to try to rescue the Jewish people. So therefore he went to the midwives and told them, look, I want you to kill the boys. If I set out a decree right now, I don't think I'll get away with it. So that's why he thought he has to work with the midwives. And they didn't do this, as we discussed on Friday. And then Pharaoh calls them in and he demands why they didn't do it. And they say, look, they're all midwives. They all give birth on their own. So our sages say, what does it mean they're all midwives? Even a midwife needs a different midwife to help her give birth. That's not an answer. Well, you could be a midwife, but what does a midwife do? Okay. The way a woman is built, so the baby is in the womb, and the womb is sealed shut. And as we come closer to the time of pregnancy, the time of delivery, so the whole system goes down. There's a process called implantation, where at some point the head, which weighs most in the baby's body, the head goes down, hopefully, because of the weight, and then the whole sack comes down and gets implanted between her feet. A woman could spend the 9th month feeling like she's got a ball in between her feet. It's really the baby's head. Now, as that happens, that pressure slowly causes the opening of the womb to open. And it opens. By the way, you should know every finger is 2 centimeters. That's how they measure. They say, how many fingers does she open? So a nurse, they look inside. That's one of the things that they check. How open the uterus is. And the uterus has to open, 10 centimeters, has to be fully open. And then the baby starts coming out. Now, if a woman tries to push before it's fully open, she could tear her uterus. She could tear the everything there. And in Chazal's time, and think back 100 years, they didn't know how to sew it back up. Today, so she'll have to have a C-section if she does that. So she won't be able to give birth normally. They'll sew it up. And they'll tell her, look, we don't know that the stitches will hold through another childbirth. You have to, every birth is going to be a C-section. But in our sages' time, they didn't know how to do that. A woman like that, chances are, died during delivery. So one of the things the midwife does is she sees when it's open. She tells her how to push. And she tells her when to push, going with the contractions. But it's very dangerous to give birth without a midwife. So here they are, they're telling the king of Egypt, they're all midwives, so they know how to give birth. What difference does it make? They can't see inside. They can't see if it's open or not. Yeah?
We also use the language of the chayos.
Oh, so a midwife is called a chaya in Hebrew, right. So our sages say that when they said chayot hena, they didn't mean they're all midwives. So we were just explaining why that can't be the understanding. So our sages say that chayot hena means they're like the wild animals. The animals in the field, or you never see a wild animal calling another one and telling it, help me out, I gotta give birth. So they said that's how the Jewish women are. They could all manage on their own. And our sages say that that's alluded to in Yaakov's blessings, that Yaakov compared each shevet, each tribe was compared to a different wild animal. Reuben not, but then it was made up. So he says, and not each tribe, but many of the tribes were compared to wild animals. And this shows that the Jewish people had this strength. The truth is, they all needed midwives, and these midwives were lying. So they got away with it. And then we have something very strange. The pasuk says, "Vayelech ish mi beis Levi." A man went from the house of Levi, and he took the daughter of Levi. Who is this person? We only know later on by default, because it says he had a son, and he was exceptional. And as we continue the story, we find out that this son, they saw he was an exceptional son. They tried to hide him. They couldn't hide him anymore, so they made this little boat. They built a little boat for him. They put him in a basket, some kind of basket with mortar and tar all around it. They put it in the water, and Pharaoh's daughter sees him. She takes him out of the Nile, and then she can't breastfeed him. He doesn't want to drink any of the women's milk. So his sister, who's watching from the side, doesn't tell us who the sister is. We don't have a name. Everything here is anonymous. This sister runs up to Pharaoh's daughter, and she says, "You know, I'll call you one of the Jewish women to be a nurse for you." And she goes and calls the mother, and Pharaoh's daughter tells the kid's mother. She doesn't know it's the mother. She tells this Jewish woman. She tells him, "You take this child, you nurse him, and I'll pay you for it, and you help him grow up." And then he grows up, and then at the end of the story, he's brought to Pharaoh's daughter. Pharaoh's daughter sees him, and she says, "Ooh, I pulled you out of the water." Pulling out of the water means to be Moshe, to pull out. So I'm going to call you Moshe. End the story. Now we have someone who's identified. The Torah doesn't identify who Moshe's parents were. Huh.
So it seems that Moshe wasn't named until he was at least a few, if not many years old.
Right. That's what it seems like.
So it seems he also most likely had a Jewish name.
No? Yeah, they say his name was Tuvia. There are a few different midrashim what his name was. The Midrash says he has a lot of names. One of them is Tuvia. So what's going on here? Why does the Torah describe it in an anonymous fashion?
In case anyone got in trouble, it doesn't even say the name.
So maybe the Torah is stressing a few ideas. Maybe the Torah is telling us, you know the greatest prophet? You know the greatest person who ever lived, who spoke to God? We say panim el panim. No one ever came close to Moshe Rabbeinu. Look at the greatest person. And who were his parents? There was a man. There was a woman. This man took the daughter of Levi. And she had a son. And this son grew up to be the greatest person in the world. No angels. No stories about a barn. No story about angels coming down or nothing. No, very simple story. You guys get the hint? No. Yeah? Okay.
Levi
yeah?
was the lowest of tribes.
Levi at this point is not the lowest of tribes anymore because every tribe is working as a slave. And Levi, Levi walks in and says, "Hey, I learned Torah. I'm not working."
But they were almost not cursed, but they didn't get the greatest blessing.
Right. They weren't high up there. Our sages say that a different thing happened here. Our sages say that what happened was this man was the leader of the Jewish people at the time. His name was Amram. And when Pharaoh decreed that every son that's born will be thrown into the Nile, so Amram said to his wife, "What are we working for? What are we having children for? We had a son, we had a daughter." Pruvu, they were Mekayim, right? They had a son and a daughter. They fulfilled the mitzvah at the Pruvu. He says, "Why should we have more children now? Why should we work to have more children to be thrown into the Nile?" So he divorced him. So Amram gave Yocheved a get. The Jewish people saw that their great leader Amram, he divorced his wife. So every man divorced his wife. And one day Amram is there and his daughter Miriam was a little kid at this point. She must have been 3-5 years old. She says, "Dad, I want you to know you're worse than Paro." She says, "Really? Why?" Notice he didn't snack her. The Midrash doesn't say. He said, "Guy, how dare you say that?" The greatest leader of the Jewish people, what does he do? He tells his daughter, "Why?" And his daughter tells him, "Pharaoh said there shouldn't be any boys in the Jewish people. And your decree, you're causing everyone to be divorced. There won't be boys or girls." And he said, "You know what? You're right." So he listened to his little daughter. Think about what a great person he was. That's a great person. In Judaism, we look at a great person not as someone who, look at who I am. No, someone who's willing to listen to other people. So Amram listens to his daughter and he remarries his wife. And the Midrash says that when he remarried his wife, his children were very happy. Aaron and Miriam had tambourines, and they started dancing. And they made a chuppah for them, and they were dancing in front of them, walking them down to the aisle to the wedding. And that's the story. Vayelach ish mi beis Levi. The man from the house of Levi went. Where did he go? Vayikach es bas Levi. He took the daughter of Levi, and we know he already had two children from this woman. We know Aaron and Miriam are Moshe's older siblings. So he's retaking the daughter of Levi. He's retaking Yocheved, who's an old lady. Yocheved is 100 and something years old, 130 something years old. Yocheved's an old lady. She just had two children. And he remarries her. And she gets pregnant. And then their daughter starts prophesizing. This little girl starts running around the house saying, my mother is going to give birth to a child who's going to redeem the Jewish people. And when the baby's born, and they see the house filled with light, so Amram picks Miriam up, and he kisses her on her head, and he says, here's your prophecy. The baby's being born. And then they hide him, and they see they can manage. And then they see they're not going to get away with it. The Egyptians are checking houses, and according to their configurations, they measured from the time that Amram took her back. Our sages say that she was already pregnant when he divorced her. So that's why he was born 3 months before their calculations. And when those 3 months were up, they saw the Egyptians are going to come and look for a baby. So at that point, they took him and put him in a casket in the Nile. And at that point, Miriam's father slapped her on the head. He says he hit her on her head and he said, where's your prophecy now? Mm-hmm. And that's our sages say that's why she was standing there in the brush. She was standing behind the bushes looking on. She was saying, wait a second, I had this prophecy. I want to see what's going to happen with my prophecy. And, yeah.
Is there a problem that Aharon, the Kohen Gadol, the son, I guess it was after the fact, right? But Moshe also actually was a Kohen, and he was...
The son of a divorced couple? It's not a problem.
As long as it's not that he wasn't a Kohen.
A Kohen can't marry a divorcee.
Yeah.
Parents?
But it makes a Kohen Pesul to the son of a divorcee.
I'll tell you more than that. Amram married his aunt. Halachically, that's forbidden. When the Torah was given, they had to get divorced again because Amram could not marry his aunt. An uncle could marry a niece, but a person can't marry his aunt. So Moshe Rabbeinu came from a nephew marrying his aunt. And when the Torah was given, they had to get divorced.
Didn't the Jewish also say, sorry, that Zipporah remarried after she got divorced? And she was married to another man for...
Another man? No, that I never heard.
When they got divorced, they read the Midrash that she was remarried someone else.
Show me that.
Say the
Midrash. I never saw it. Okay,
and
you say so?
So that she remarried Amram.
Amram or...
No, before she remarried Amram, she was...
You're talking about Yocheved or Tzipora?
Not Tzipora. Her mother.
Her mother-in-law, Yocheved. Show me, we'll see. I don't know. So, Pharaoh's daughter takes him in. And Pharaoh's daughter, our sages say, this is the way God deals with tzaddikim. That not only does Yocheved get to bring up her own son, but she's getting paid to nurse him. She is the paid nurse to bring up her son. And Moshe Rabbeinu really grows up in a Jewish home. Not only a Jewish home, but he grows up in the home of the greatest leader. His father, Amram, is the leader of the Jewish people at this time. And when he stops nursing, which in those days was 2 years, this has halachic relevance, a woman for 2 years after she's born is called a meinekes. Meinekes meaning a woman who's nursing. We say that even in Judaism, that a woman potentially could nurse till 2 years, and that's why a woman for 2 years after she gives birth is called a meinekes. This has halachic relevance that sometimes if we need to, as an adjunct in halacha, sometimes we don't have enough room to be lenient with only one source. We need to put together a few reasons to be lenient. So sometimes if we have a woman who shouldn't, for whatever reason, we have a few reasons why she shouldn't fast, so we apply this also. We say, well, she's a meinekes, she's nursing. And meinekes isn't, it's a machlokes in the Gemara, but we come out that it's not contingent on whether she is practically nursing or not. So at any rate, Moshe Rabbeinu is 2 years old, 3 years old, and they bring him to Pharaoh's daughter. And she calls him Moshe. So our sages say, how did she know Hebrew? Why is she calling him Moshe? So there are two opinions among the Rishonim. One opinion says she didn't speak Hebrew. She called him Moneus, an Egyptian. The Torah translates it to Moshe, but really he was known as Moneus. That he wasn't known as Moshe.
It means the same thing?
Yeah, Moneus, an Egyptian, is Moshe. But the other opinion says that why was she going down to the Nile? So our sages say she was living in Pharaoh's house. And she saw all of Pharaoh's idol worship. And she saw the way everyone in Egypt was going. And she said, you know what? these people that everyone says are lowlifes, these Jews, they got something right. I'm going over to their religion. And our sages say that when she went down to the Nile, the daughter of Paro was going to convert. She was becoming Jewish. That Batya Bas Paro was going to the Nile to convert to Judaism. To the mikveh, right? That's why she was going to the Nile. So then it makes sense that she learned Hebrew in the process. And what was there about being Jewish at the time? Wearing Jewish clothing, having a Jewish name, speaking Hebrew, land of Israel, having one God, obviously. Maybe Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. So she spoke Hebrew. Why'd she call him Moshe? The word Moshe means one who pulls. Moshe Rabbeinu was pulled. He should have been called Moshui, one who was pulled. He didn't do the pulling, she did the pulling. So they say that this was a streak of prophecy that ran into her. That he's going to pull the whole Jewish people. That's why his name was called Moshe, not Moshui. He wasn't pulled, even though, in fact, he was pulled, but Moshe means to pull others, and that's what Moshe really did. Now, there's a Midrash that says that she was there with her, with all her servants, and she sent them to get the casket. And each one was going to say, oh, it's a Jewish boy, let him die, what do you want him for? So each one that reached the casket would drop dead, drop dead, drop dead. She was left alone. So the Midrash says that she couldn't reach it, so she extended her hand. And the Midrash says different opinions as to how far her hand extended. Now, Mitzvah, you're all going to be parents. So here's something you should show your kids. How you demonstrate a hand extending. You extend it, then you extend it some more, then some more, then some more.
Whoa.
I still remember the Rebbe in first grade showing me that. So you, when you learn the parsha with your kids, you can show them that trick.
Why would it just be?
What? It looks as though the hand is extending further. So the Midrash says that the hand extended a large distance. Think of from here till about Merkaz Arab.
Whoa!
That's if you measure the Midrash, the measurements the Midrash is saying, it's a huge distance. There are different opinions as to how far it was. So you ask yourself, if it was that far away, why'd she extend her hand? What was she thinking? If the casket was that far away that she couldn't reach it, why was she reaching it out with her hand? So that teaches us a lesson in Hishtadlut. On the one hand, God controls the world and whatever God wants is going to happen. But on the other hand, we have to do our best. And sometimes our best means we don't see how it's going to work, but we try. So she tried, and she succeeded. She opens up the casket, and she sees a child who's circumcised. And together with the child, she sees the Shekhinah. And that's why the pasuk says that "Vatiftach vatireu et hayeled." She saw him with the child. She saw God with the child. And when she saw that, she recognized, oh, this is a special child. So Moshe is growing up in Paro's household. Who else is growing up in Paro's household?
Paro's
son. It's not such a good environment to grow up in. But one thing Moshe Rabbeinu gets in Paro's household, one thing that he gets is, aside from a good education and knowing how to lead, in Paro's household, he gets the foundation of being being free. Being free. Moshe Rabbeinu did not grow up a slave. Some opinions say that the reason why the generation that left Egypt had to pass away in the desert, so we know they sinned and that's what caused it in fact, but the ideological reason was because they were slaves. They had a slave's mindset. So Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have this mindset. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he goes out of the king's castle and he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew mercilessly, he kills him. What was going on with that Jew? But let's take a step back. The Midrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was there, so Paro had three wise men, Bilam, Yisro, and Iyob. And they said, this kid is a problem. He's the one who's going to save the Jewish people. What happened? Moshe Rabbeinu was sitting on Paro's lap and he grabbed the crown off Paro's head and put it on his own head. So let's take a step back. The stargazers, when they told Paro to throw the kids into the Nile, they knew what they were saying. They saw in the stars that the Jewish leader would get hit through water. So they were right. Moshe Rabbeinu, ultimately, his mistake was when he hit the rock in order to make the water come out. So they were right, but they didn't know exactly what they were saying. So they said, try throwing all the babies into the water, that's how we'll do it. The minute that his parents put the casket into the water, so in the stars, they saw that, you know, their leader hit the water, you're okay, they told Pharaoh. You could undo the decree. We just see in the stars now that the leader hit the water. He's in the Nile. You're fine. And then he was taken out of the Nile, and he's brought into Pharaoh's home. Yeah?
Sorry to interrupt, but there are two different decrees that Pharaoh makes concerning babies. First is that all Jewish males should be thrown in the water, and the second is that all babies should be thrown in the water.
Yeah.
They're both aimed specifically at Moshe, or only the first one was aimed at depopulating the Jewish people, and the second one was aimed specifically at Moshe?
No, it seems, if I'm not mistaken, I didn't get to check the Medrash this year, but if I'm not mistaken, the Medrash says that initially he wanted to throw the Jewish babies in, and then the Egyptian stargazers told him, we see in the stars that he's going to be among Egyptians. We're not sure if the Jewish rescuer is going to come from the Jews or the Egyptians. And they told him today he was born. So on that day they told him today he was born, he panicked. So he said, oh, today he was born, so today all babies get thrown to the Nile, all males. That's one version of the Medrash. So Moshe is sitting on Pharaoh's lap, and he pulls the crown off and puts it on his own head. So his advisors say, you know, this means he's going to take the throne from you. This is a heavenly sign. So there were three advisors there discussing what to do to the Jewish people, discussing what to do to Moshe. That's why Yisro said, you shouldn't do what you're doing, so he had to flee. Eov was silent, that's why he got punished. And Bilam, he said, go for it, destroy them. Those three were advisors of Pharaoh. So at any rate, they wanted to test Moshe to see what the truth is. So they told him, how do you test a baby? Take burning coals, they'll be red hot, and take jewels and put them down and see which one he reaches for. And that'll show you whether he really knows what he's doing when he takes your crown off your head. So the Medrash says, this is a Medrash I didn't see inside, but I heard it as a child. So you saw it inside?
So
okay.
He was about to take a gold, and the angel pushed him to the coal, and
that's why he, in a way, he stutters.
So yeah. So that's what the Medrash says, right? That he was going for the gold, the angel pushed his hands to the coals, and he burnt his hand, and he quickly pulled it to the mouth, and I guess there was still some coals there, and he burnt his mouth. That's why he didn't speak well. And when he touched the coals, they said, okay, that's a sign that he's not going for the throne.
That saved his life, basically.
That saved his life, yeah. So he grows up and he goes out and he sees his brethren, he sees them suffering. And he sees an Egyptian. And what happened with that Egyptian? That Egyptian saw a man by the name of Dasan. We're going to run across this pair, Dasan and Aviram, again and again. So this Dasan had a beautiful wife named Shlomis. Shlomis Bas Divri. And she used to tell everyone hello whenever they walked by. She was too friendly. Too friendly for everyone's good. So what this Egyptian did was he saw this beautiful woman. So he came in the middle of the night and he told Dasan, get up, time to go to work. And Dasan went to work and this Egyptian came back into the house and went into bed. Now the woman thought it was her husband coming back into bed. And then they were together like husband and wife. And then the Egyptian left. And then Dasan came back from working a murderous night. He came back home and he understood what happened. And he went out and the Egyptian saw him coming out of the house. So he saw that Dasan figured out what happened. So he started beating Dasan mercilessly. He didn't want word to get out. So Moshe walks onto the scene and sees this man beating Dasan mercilessly. And he looks at him. And our sages say that when he looked at him, he asked God, is there... ever going to be anyone good coming out of this man? Is there, throughout the generations, when you kill a person, you're not only killing him, you're killing all of his offsprings. If I let him live, is there any good going to come out of him? And he heard that not. So he said one of God's secret names, and the man dropped dead. And then he told the Jews around him, shh, no one say a word. I'm trusting you to be silent. The Pasuk says he hid him in the sand. Our sages say that what it means was he hid him among the Jewish people who are comparable to the sand. He told the Jewish people, don't say a word. And the next day he comes out and he sees two people fighting. One of them is Dasan, the other one is Aviram. Doesn't say that in the Pasuk, that's what our sages tell us. One of the people fighting was this man who he saved the day before. And he sees one about to hit his friend and he tells him, Rasha, why do you want to hit him? And he tells him, who appointed you as judge? You want to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? I'll go tell Pharaoh.
the Russia before.
And Moshe Rabbeinu sees from this, he says, you're going to go tell on me to Paro? I just saved a Jew, you're going to tell? And according to one opinion, I just saved you? And Moshe Rabbeinu said, Achen oda davar. So it's known now. So the simple understanding is, Moshe Rabbeinu said, if you know, and you say you're going to tell Paro, then everyone knows, and I'm in trouble. But our sages say that Moshe Rabbeinu spent his childhood wondering, why are my people suffering more than anyone else? Why? And when he saw that one Jew was willing to tattletale, to snitch, to say bad things about another Jew, when he saw Lashon Hara among them, he said, now I know why. Now I know why the Jewish people deserve what they're getting. Paro heard that Moshe killed an Egyptian, and he wanted to kill Moshe, and Moshe fled. The Medrash says that more than that happened. Paro caught Moshe. Medrash says that he brought him before his executioner. And at that point, each one started getting sick. One, his hand didn't work, the executioner. One Medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu's throat became hard as rock, so the knife didn't cut it. And then someone else wanted to chase after him, and he couldn't run, and he wanted to yell, and he couldn't talk. Each one got a different bruise in his body, so they couldn't take care of Moshe, and Moshe just walked out of the courtroom and ran to Midian. And that's why when Moshe Rabbeinu is later on going to tell God, how could I take the Jewish people out of Egypt? I can't talk. Well, God will tell him, who gives man the ability to talk, or see, or speak? Who's the one that caused all your executioners? This one couldn't talk, this one couldn't listen, this one couldn't see. You see, I control the world. So what are you telling me you can't talk? Well, you can't take out the Jewish people. Our sages say that it was on purpose that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't take them out, so that future generations wouldn't say, you know, he was a con artist. He spoke very, very well, Moshe Rabbeinu. That's how he got the Jewish people out. He got them to believe there's a God. He got them to believe in Sinai. He knew how to speak well. So God purposely wanted a leader who could not speak well. Moshe who stutters, or Moshe who has a bad mouth. However it is, Moshe can't speak clearly. No one could say that this person conned 600,000 people into believing there's a God. So Moshe Rabbeinu runs to Egypt, to Midian, and over there he sees girls coming out to draw water from the well, and the shepherds start harassing them. And he can't stand seeing injustice. What's he doing? Who's he? He just got here. Injustice is something that should run in a person's blood. He's a foreigner, he just walked in. Nonetheless, he can't stand seeing injustice. So why were the shepherds harassing the girls? Our sages say that their father had been a priest. Their father had led idol worship for years. And each time he did try to discover which was the correct idol, he'd go from idol to idol until finally he said, they're all wrong. The only God is the Jewish God. So everyone hated him. They ostracized him. And when his daughters tried to get water from the well, they gave them trouble. And Moshe Rabbeinu saved them. And that day they come home early, and their grandfather or their father asks them what's going on. And they tell him, an Egyptian saved us from the shepherds, and he drew water for us.
This bugs me a lot. There's nowhere in scripture that says he said he was an Egyptian.
Oh.
They assume that he's an Egyptian because he's dressed like an Egyptian. How come he's criticized by the sages that he said he was Egyptian, or he never denied he was Egyptian, but he doesn't say anywhere that he said he was an Egyptian. So it says that they said he was an Egyptian.
We have to look at that Midrash inside, but we have to remember that the Torah doesn't record those stories. Mm. When the Torah records something, the Torah is recording it in a certain manner for a certain reason. Sometimes the Torah quotes two words from a sentence. Torah doesn't say that they came home and they said, hi, Dad. Doesn't say that, right? Mm. So it quotes excerpts from a conversation, which might have happened this way or might have happened a different way. This is the way the Torah chooses to present it with a certain idea in mind. We have to understand what the Torah is trying to tell us. Torah says, Moshe saved them. He gave their sheep to drink. What do I care that he gave them their sheep to drink? Maybe it's teaching us to be a gentleman. They come to Reuel, their father. Why does the Torah have to say that? The Torah tells us the whole discussion that goes on between them. He says, why'd you leave him there? Call him in, we'll offer him bread. Or say, just say he meant call him in. Maybe he'll marry one of you. You're not going to have an easy time with the shidduch with me as a father, right? So he says, call him in. Why is that important? If the Torah is telling that to us, then we have to know that the Torah wants us to understand things from it. Our sages say, and I think we're going to have to end with this, no. That's a medrash that's not so important for today, so we'll skip it. Moshe marries Zipporah's daughter and he promises him he won't leave without his consent. That's what he promises Yisrael. And those days, the Pasuk says the king of Egypt died. Our sages say it doesn't mean he died, but it means he became a leper, he got tzaras. And his advisors told him that the way to cure it was to bathe in blood. So he was taking Jewish children and slaughtering them and bathing in their blood. And this was to add salt to injury. The Jewish people started crying out to God. And God remembered his treaty. God heard their crying and he remembered his treaty. So what's this duality? Either he heard their cry and that's why he's going to save them, or he remembered his treaty that he promised he'd take them out. So our sages say that we find in the prophet Yechezkel says that God asked the Jewish people, stop serving idols. Our sages say that God sent Aaron. Moshe Rabbeinu's big brother, Aaron, was the first prophet that came to the Jewish people and said, stop serving idols and I'll save you. And the Jewish people said, no, we're continuing to serve idols. And God got upset. God, so to speak, God got upset. God said, okay, so you should be destroyed. And then God said, I promise. I made a treaty with Avram that I'm going to save them. And God saved us from Egypt, not because we deserved it, but because of the treaty. That's an important thing to remember. Very often we find Moshe Rabbeinu also tells God, do it for your name, for your sake. We say it every day in Shemona Esrei. We say, Leman Shemo Ba'ava, right? At the end of the first blessing. We say, God, Umevi Goel Ibnei Vnehem, God brings redeemers to the Jewish people, Leman Shemo, for God's name. Not necessarily because we deserve it. We say it in benching, we say it often. And that's the concept that's being hidden over here. God heard our crying on the one hand, but on the other hand, God remembered his promise. God saw the Jewish people, Vayeda Elohim, God knew. So our sages say, what does it mean, Vayeda Elohim? God knew what no one else knows but God. God knew that the Jewish people were no longer living with their wives. They no longer had strength to do even that much. Moshe Rabbeinu takes the sheep out into the desert where they won't be grazing off other people's land. And he sees a vision. So the simple understanding is he sees this fire in this bush and he sees the bush burning and it keeps burning and burning and burning and never burns up. But we know that prophecy doesn't show up to the naked eye. Prophecy is something that a person sees with his neshama. He didn't see a bush. What is the sneh? The sneh is a bush that has needles pointing down, inward. In China they have this. They have... it's like the koishklach that you have for your lulav. It's this thing where you put in a finger and then you try to take it out and it gets tight when you try to take it out. And this is how the sneh was. It was built with thorns pointing inward. You could stick your hand in easily. When you try to take it out, all the thorns would go into your hand. And the idea of God showing up in the sneh was firstly to show that's how Mitzrayim was. The Jewish people entered easily to Egypt. Like you could stick your hand into this thorn bush. But now that they want to get out, it's not going to be easy. We're going to see a lot of Jews are going to have to die in the process. A lot of Egyptians are going to die in the process. It's not going to be easy. Secondly, it shows God's humility. God doesn't choose the greatest tree to show up in. God appears in the lowly little thorn bush. And thirdly, it shows that God is with the Jewish people, so to speak, in their pain. When things are going well for the Jewish people, so then God appears in a highly manner. When the Jewish people are in pain, so God shows up on a lowly bush. Our sages say that this was Moshe's first prophecy, and God didn't want to scare Moshe. So first God appeared to Moshe in his father's voice, so he thought he heard his father talking to him. And then God introduced himself. And this teaches us derech eretz. Say hello, say good morning, to introduce ourselves, to begin a conversation with small talk. You don't go straight to the point. It's one thing that people, for some reason in Israeli society, tend to forget. Like they hit you straight over the head. And I know... I didn't notice this until I came back to the United States after being here like a few years. And I was doing that. And one of my rabbin gave me over the head. And I said, hey, he's right. He even says it over here. God started with small talk. He comes to Adam, to Adam, and he tells him, where are you? God cares where he is. God knows where he is. That's small talk. That's starting a conversation.
Stop.
Right. We're out of time. Stop.